Hi, everybody. I'm Daniel Berwin. Welcome to Reinventing the Graphic Novel for the iPad. Super honored to be here. A year ago, I saw Gray Rucka and Robert Rodriguez speak on the stage, so it's kind of cool to see it come full circle. So I'll just dive right into it. So who I am. My background's in graphic design and video games, so that means that I work at the intersection of art and technology. And I wanted to apply my unique background to tell a story of historical significance. So I'm going to spend some time sort of talking about a cultural framing of what the work that I did is, and then do an actual case study of CIA Operation Ajax. And at the end, I'll hopefully have about 15 or 20 minutes for Q&A, and I really hope that my presentation today leaves you guys with a lot of questions. So not everyone necessarily knows what this is. I'm going to show the trailer first, since it can be difficult to describe what an interactive iPad graphic novel is, and then we'll go from there.
Introducing Operation Ajax for the iPad, based on actual events of the CIA's involvement in overthrowing the Iranian government, a bold and original interactive graphic novel that redefines digital comics and the art of storytelling in 210 handcrafted pages. Navigating the comic is easy and intuitive. Tap or swipe to read the next page or to go back. Touching the middle of the screen gives you more control and lets you dive deeper into the rich history surrounding the story. At the bottom of the screen, we can flip through pages. It's also easy to jump to different chapters. A handy guide can be called up to provide a synopsis of the cast of characters. Occasionally, you'll see a star while reading. Touch it to pull up additional information about key story points, historical documents that have only recently been declassified, and even newsreels from the era. Operation Ajax by Cognito Comics. Experience it at the App Store.
Cool. So, anyway, thanks. That's our product trailer, but I feel like that really kind of gives you guys at least a teaser of what I'm going to be talking about next. But more on that later. For now, I'd like to direct your attention to this. This is a Stradivarius. It's an extremely rare violin. Even if you had the millions of dollars it would take to potentially buy one of these, there's only about 650, according to Wikipedia, that are around in the world today. And the reason I want to use this as a metaphor for the topic of my presentation today is that when I think of the world of media, you know, before there was recordings, there was performance, and there was a sort of artisanal, handcrafted quality to everything we did as storytellers, as performers. And the Stradivarius kind of sums up, I think, the epitome of the valuable, unique, handcrafted, analog past. And so let's say you wanted one of these today. Well, fear not. 3D printing technology has actually made this possible. You can now, according to The Economist, 3D print your own Stradivarius. And I think that's very interesting because we're now seeing digital technology allowing us to infinitely duplicate this handcrafted analog past for all of our media. And supposedly this actually sounds pretty good. Oh. Not bad for something you can theoretically download off the internet, right? So the question I want to propose to you guys today is, how do we honor and maintain the value of our analog, tangible past in the age of digital media? And that's just sort of a question to kind of keep in the back of your heads. It's something I've been asking myself a lot over the time I'm spending on making comics for the iPad. So while we're on the topic of music, I just want to sort of do a little mini case study on this really fast. Music as an activity was very different back in the day. I remember, the Maxell advertising. You used to actually sit down and devote your attention to listening to music as if it was this, like, activity. And I think that really relates to the fact that our music was a physical thing, you know? You would put on your CD or your tape, and you would actually be beholden to the experience that the artist had created for you. And this really fundamentally changed when we went digital with the iPod, right, and the whole MP3 revolution, because now we're controlling the experience. We want to have our music in a certain order, and the music is no longer physical. You've had that 80 gigabyte hard drive with like a billion songs on it, and your friend would come over, and suddenly you'd like swap and like instantly have twice as much music. And it was like this hassle to organize your iTunes library, and we didn't even want to do that anymore. Now music has gone to a service, right? You just type in the name of things you like, and a computer's like, oh, maybe you'll like this. this, or maybe you'll like that. And I find that a very interesting evolution of media in music, because we've gone from tangible to digital to service. And our relationship with this with music has changed fundamentally because of that. If you think about actually putting on a record and sitting down and listening to it, that's a dedicated activity that we don't really do anymore. I don't know when the last time is any of you actually like put on music and sat down and like intentionally listened to that album all the way through. I mean, I like to do it. I pour myself a cup of bourbon and like sit down in front of the hi-fi, but I'm like a random weird dude who does that. You know, music now, because it's digital, is something we consume, you know, in the background on headphones while we're doing a billion other things. And I think that's really just something that's happening with all of our media. It's all kind of going into a service-based format, right? Games are going this way with OnLive, TV with Hulu. You know, I remember when TiVo came out and, like, nobody got it until you used it, and you're like, wow, why would I ever, like, schedule my time to watch TV after that? And then, of course, movies and music are going that way as well. And what I find so interesting about all of this is that we're consuming these services, all of our media services, on our phones, and basically the same place we're doing all of our communication. So suddenly all of our attention is being divided up into smaller and smaller pieces, where we're also constantly getting texted, and we're doing social media, and push notifications are happening, and we're playing games there. And it's just, it gets us to be this really cacophonous, noisy, crazy space where all these things are constantly competing for our attention. And it's a real departure, I think, from that original image of the Maxell guy sitting down and devoting all of his attention on one thing. And of all of the media formats to cross over into digital, the one that I think is the most sort of profoundly anti this culture is the book. Yay, books, right? I Googled books, and this is like the first image that popped up. And I'm like, of course, that's exactly what I was looking for. yeah, I think it's really interesting when you go on vacation, you take a book with you to unplug and to get away from all of the distraction and all of the noise of our lives. And there's something inherently sacred about that. You know, Andrew Stanton just did this TED Talk on story that was phenomenal, like in February, if you guys saw it. And he talked about how you have to make the audience work for their lunch, so to speak. And I think that books are really sort of the epitome of that. You know, you have this limited language of 26 characters, I guess, in English, right, plus punctuation. And you have to really focus on what you're reading. You can't really divide your attention up while you're reading. You might be able to listen to music and watch TV and play a game all intermittently while you're tweeting and doing what else. But books are really the opposite of that. And I think that there's something kind of romantic and sacred about that. So I see books as the opposite of noise and distraction. You know, books have gone digital. It's not like this is news to us. I think it's very interesting that Amazon was the first company to try to do this while really respecting and embracing that past of the sacredness of the page, so to speak. You know, the Kindle was successful because of what it didn't do. You know, you couldn't browse email on it. You couldn't make phone calls from it. You couldn't surf the web. And I think in a way that's why it worked. That's why, you know, the Kindle is successful. It goes digitally carefully, and it's really good at maintaining that, you know, that book experience. And then the iPad comes out. And here you have the same culture of the phone now trying to do books as well, and things are starting to converge like crazy, and it's nuts. And it's not necessarily bad. I think it's more interesting, more like a science experiment. You know, you see little kids, he's flipping you the bird. I thought that was kind of funny. Anyway, I didn't even notice that until I was rehearsing, and people were like, did you know? And I'm like, eh. But kids' books especially, right? You're seeing, like, animation and interactivity and all these new formats starting to cross over and intersect with each other. And it's happening really fast, and it's a fascinating space to watch because there's no right way to do it yet. And I don't even know if there's a wrong way necessarily. There's definitely apps that are more successful than others. This is one of my favorites. This is Bobo Explorer's Light by Game Collage. And I don't know if you guys have gotten a chance to play this one yet. I say play because you actually control this little robot, and you do these like interactive experiences to explore the physics of light. And it's really cool. And what's so fascinating to me about this app is that it isn't just like that's the only part of it. There's these pull-down menus with like videos and text and images, and you'd think that would be great for learning. And yet, when you contrast that with the actual interactive sections of making this robot like play with laser beams and stuff, it's so boring. Like, you don't even want to deal with it. You're like, oh, I'm glad you threw that in there so I feel good paying my $6 for this. But really, you just want to make the robot like shine lasers at things. So it definitely shows the contrast, I think, between the old and the new when it comes to how to learn about a concept. I think everyone here knows Morris Lessmore by now, right? They just won an Oscar for their short film. And, you know, again, a very successful way of taking a very rich story and repurposing it in sort of the app space and leveraging all that is film and all that is books and so on and so forth, like having a piano in the middle of the story. This is one of my personal favorite games. Everyone here knows Sword and Sorcery, I hope. This is by Cappy Games. Super awesome. The character carries a book on his back, and you can pull it out, and then when he takes out the book, the whole screen says, rotate the iPad, and suddenly you go from a widescreen game experience to a book experience where you're actually talking through Twitter posts. It's so meta, it's crazy. But I really appreciate when creators actually take a conscious step towards this stuff and do a good job. And so it's sort of like taking the ultimate media consumption device and then going up one level, right, with the advent of the book. And it's evolving so fast, there isn't even language to describe this stuff. And I guess what I want to offer you guys today is, you know, thinking as media creators, as people who work in this industry, how can we actually add value to our media when we go digital? So I'm going to take another little case study here. I'll talk about photography for a second. So I serendipitously hit puberty the same time that America Online became a thing. And so that means that I ended up just doing online dating because it just happened to all match up randomly when I was like 13 years old. And you'd be chatting to like women who didn't go to my high school or junior high, like on the internet via text. And it was fascinating. I really, really enjoyed it. And you had to eventually, you feel very popular. I don't know. You can be very eloquent when no one knows what you look like, I guess. But then they would ask you for a photograph and you're like, oh, that's a very odd request. How do I give you a photograph over the internet? And you would like rifle through your box of photos and you hopefully had that one really good one, and then you'd have to like find a scanner and get it onto the computer, and it was this like crazy clusterfuck of how do you send someone a photo. And you maybe had like, you know, two if you were really tech savvy, right? You know, everyone had their one photo. But now photos are viewed on screens primarily through Flickr and through, you know, Instagram. You know, everyone is carrying a digital camera with them at all times. And so now that photography is being shown on screens, how do we embrace that? How do we actually, you know, take advantage of the fact that we have a digital display backing our photos? It's very tempting to like throw in all these other things that would fundamentally change it, but I think you can actually do it well. But sometimes not that well. This is a cinemagraph. These are getting a lot of press right now, and there's a whole different version of these. It's this new experiment. And there's ways to be successful, and there's ways not to be, just like with anything else. This, to me, is very distracting. I think that this is kind of destroying the essence of the photograph in a way. I can't ignore this. I have to stare at the constant stream of repetitive taxis. But more than anything else, there's this sharp contrast between the frozen people crossing the street and the stream of taxis that's kind of a little bit confusing, right? But let me offer you Exhibit B. So I can see there's a pretty profound difference here, right? You know, I mean, it's the same idea, having a taxi cab going by, you know, in a photograph. But this to me is actually really beautiful and actually really eloquent. And I think that when it comes to making a photograph come alive, this is a really successful way to do that. As an art director, what I see here is that, you know, the stuff that is static, it makes sense staying static. And the things that move make sense moving, and they're ignorable, right? And so I can give it my attention if I want to, just like a real photograph. Plus, the taxi is a reflection. So anyway, there's all these layers you could go deep with that. But that's just an idea of how if you introduce motion, just like any other tool to the photographer now, this is one other way to make photography successful in the digital space. So we can add value in the digital space. It can happen. So I'm going to talk to you now about the origin story behind Operation Ajax. So in 2002, when we went into Iraq, I personally was left asking a lot of questions, and I didn't feel like I was getting the whole story from the media. And then I found Stephen Kinzer's work through my parents. I read a book called Overthrow, and then later All the Shah's Men, and it was like it just blew my brain open. I found all these stories that were so important to me that I was like, wow, this is how we, you know, this explains all these missing pieces of the puzzle that aren't being discussed in the mainstream media. And that's sort of a whole other topic, so I won't go too deep with that. But suffice to say, I got really inspired, and I said, wow, how great would it be if I could leverage my background with art and technology, and instead of telling stories about Tony Hawk, if I could actually, you know, tell stories about, you know, all the Shah's men and all these other countries we've been involved with. And at the time, this was the console era, so games are going to cost you millions of dollars and, you know, arguably are still struggle to do a narrative today. So I didn't think that games were going to be the best format for presenting the story. I needed to do a narrative. I had left Activision recently. I was teaching. It was kind of the perfect time to try to take on something new. And so I figured maybe a graphic novel would be something cool. And it was actually this book that changed my view towards that format. I discovered this book. This is Torso by Brian Michael Bendis. So if anyone here is a comics fan, you're probably well aware of who he is. He did this book in 2000. And this book fundamentally changed my view of what comics could be, especially with a graphic design background. I'll show you a couple pages, but I had grown up with Marvel and DC, sort of, you know, comics, sort of superhero stuff. And here was this true-to-life, you know, a spy thriller from the Prohibition era, done in, like, completely black and white. And these guys just indulge like crazy. This book is super thick, and it's like every composition is across two pages, and there's all this negative space. And it was like no comic I'd ever seen before. And they had taken actual, you know, newspaper clippings and put them right into the compositions. And it wasn't exactly true to life. It was very much inspired by, but it centers around Elliot Ness and a serial killer. And so they use actual artifacts from the times to sort of talk about this story. And I found this book to just be profound because I never thought comics could be, you know, could look like this. So I really like when you can indulge and break up the experience and really play off of, you know, what the comics language can do when you are free to experiment. You know, this is kind of interesting because here the comics are flowing sideways. You'd actually have to turn the book, you know, to read the story. And as it gets more and more intense, there's this crazy, like, descent into madness spiral that happens. But I don't want to ruin it for you. I highly recommend checking it out. So we ended up creating two products. We first started out to doing a fully traditional print graphic novel, and then 2010 the iPad came along and totally changed the whole thing. And what that ended up meaning is that we did a 210-page historically accurate book and an interactive iPad experience, and we were going to need assets that would satisfy both of these products. So coming from a games and animation background, jumping into comics for the first time, naively assuming that it was going to be easy, I had a lot to learn. It's a completely different industry, completely different rules, and a completely different culture. Obviously, making games is different than making comics. And let me present to you this team that made Deus Ex, Human Revolution, in the top left, right? It's a team of like 60 people or so, versus the guys who made Watchmen, in the bottom right. There's so many different layers to this, but what it really boils down to, I think, is ownership. You know, comics are made by people who can take full ownership over their part of the process. If you are like Craig Thompson, you can do the writing and the art yourself and take 6 years, and it's a true expression of your creative drive. If you're a commercial artist on a team of 60 people making a video game, you know, the mentality is very different, and you're willing to make, I think, certain sacrifices just because you're part of a team, and that's just how, you know, it works when the budget is $50 million. For one of these things. And so that was really hard for me to get at first. And it took a long time to really embrace that and to figure out how to let artists be artists and still leverage all that's great about, you know, a digital workflow and things like that. I'll talk more about that in a minute. What I think this means ultimately is that comics at their heart are artisanal. They're really, you know, beautiful works of art. And there can be a real struggle, a real disconnect, especially in the world of mobile software, I think, between something that's artisanal and something that needs to be iterated quickly and, you know, it tested and experimented with and constantly chopped up and played with. So they're two different cultures for sure. I had to learn some basic rules of comics. Scott McCloud's book was super instrumental in helping me out. I remember I saw him at Comic-Con a while ago, and I actually got his attention for a while, and he told me that everything I was doing was wrong, but it was it was nice to at least have him take a look. But some of the basic rules here were really simple for the most part, right? With American comics, you go left to right, top to bottom, 6 panels on page average, when to use insets, when to use splash panels, that sort of thing. But the key part of comics language is the page turn. It's like absolutely critical to how comics work. It's just, you know, printed books, comics go in that, and therefore, as you're reading a story, there's this natural pause where you have to turn the page. What that means is that you have to end every page on a cliffhanger, and the structure of the page is like a key pillar to comics language. To show you a couple pages from Ajax, these are just some inks to kind of keep it clear, but this is 4 pages, a 2-page spread in the middle, and the gray dots are the start and ending points, which is probably no duh for people who read comics, but just to sort of talk about this, there's a rhythm here. So when you end on the first page, you have Avril Harriman stepping out of an airplane with this big kind of like, what next, right? And then we cut to a reverse shot of him on the next page to try to continue that arc. And all hell breaks loose. There's a lot of angry protesting Iranians out there, and the whole thing kind of goes to hell. And Avril Harriman has to like jump into this car, and then you're left with this what next moment. And then we cut to him inside the car, peeking out the window, and Truman gets this telegram from him saying that it's just all been a huge failure, and then forlorn Truman looking out the window. And so there's this rhythm of like, what next, what next, what next? And what's so fascinating to me about this is that when comics go digital, one of the first things you have to sacrifice is the page. This is sort of that same movement with a little bit of like an NHL, or NFL, play-by-play. You have the red dots that sort of show the rest points and the green arrows connecting between them. And so this is sort of how your eye would travel over those printed pages. And so, like I said, this is really a challenge when you want to put a page of comics on a phone screen, for example, right? You suddenly lose this major pillar of how that whole thing works. And there's different ways to work around this, but what you're ultimately left with is a presentation issue. Text doesn't seem to suffer this so much because you can reflow text infinitely and it all reads about the same, but comics are really key to, to relying on that page structure to be successful. I'll show you an example of how Marvel has tried to do this. So everyone should be familiar with the Comixology app. They kind of made this sort of presentation popular. But this originally came from a sort of phone mentality where you kind of go panel by panel, and that allows you to have hopefully the best of both worlds, sort of. You know, you can try to, at least see what's there and make it legible. And it's kind of a sacrifice. You get the portability in a small screen, but the trade-off is that you, take the comics with you. So anyway. That's one way to do that. It really comes down to how you want to present your content, and that's one of the downsides of putting stuff on a phone. Then the other side of it, just like with the cinemagraph, and you could really retitle my entire presentation, How to Add Motion to Comics Without Making Them Suck, but comics at their core are a reading experience, right? So there's no spoken dialogue if you're going to add sound. Comics allow you to advance the story at your own pace, so not a video experience. Most people are probably familiar with motion comics here, right? Yeah, okay, I'm just going to show you an example, and I'm kind of cringe a little
bit. Tell me, which stage of grieving is this? Denial. Strike a nerve, Summers.
This is good. The guy who's tried to steal my wife since the day he met us is going to tell me all about what's proper.
Only reason genius.
All right, well, anyway, you guys get the idea. I don't think he
was too strong.
Yeah, all right, so enough of that, sorry. We didn't want to do that. We really wanted to just avoid that at all costs. And I think that when you describe what we do as a motion comic, that's why I get a little like icky, because that's people coming with film language instead of comics language trying to make something new and add motion and add sound. I can't say it's a hard and fast rule, but I found that most people who do motion comics are motion graphics houses given the comics assets, and they go, oh, well, if we're going to add motion, we should make animation, and that's not really the whole point of that. So we wanted to find a solution that would allow us to add motion and sound to a comics presentation while respecting the rules of comics, and that's really what I want to talk about next. And so our workflow for doing Ajax is really not that different. Like I said, it's a 210-page book. So we thumbnailed out everything. My writer came from animation and animated film, and he was able to thumbnail out all this stuff, which is really helpful. We go to a layered ink, and then we finally color and letter everything, which probably doesn't look that different. Everyone here is probably like, well, that's obvious, right? There's one key difference with our art. Every page is broken into panel, and every panel is broken into pieces. On average, about 5 layers, not including the text, right? And if you think about an average of, say, 5 panels per page, that comes out to about 6,000 to 7,000 pieces of art for the entire book. This is that same page you saw before, fully colored and lettered, right? It's really one of my favorite pieces of artwork. It's very beautiful. If you actually break this apart into pieces, it becomes these texture sheets. So you can see all the elements of a single page from Operation Ajax. Looks like, well, it's actually 4 of these for that. So you can see all the pieces here. So needless to say, that was a lot of work. So that's 2 pages out of 210. And so we had a lot of challenges with this. We had to use a team-based illustration approach, which gave us the best of both worlds. This gave us reliability and speed in exchange for a consistent visual style. Because one of the downsides is that if you're using a single artist, you're limited to how fast that artist can go. And again, it's that struggle between making a mobile product or a digital product, right, with the games background versus the artisanal approach with regular comics. So we mitigated this the consistent visual style problem by using the same colorist across every page. It took 3 years to make the 210-page graphic novel, and 2 years alone for the script. And I think that's just a testament to how important story is. That was a real big lesson for me. So I'm going to go ahead and switch now to show you guys some of the app. So I'm going to pop the audio here as well. Oh, cool. sound? Awesome. So I'm going to go ahead and just give you a little bit of a tour of how all this stuff actually works together. So you can hear sound. Basically, every time I tap to advance, the content's going to reformat itself, and the music's going to change ever so slightly. So it doesn't actually, you can actually go forward and backwards. And so it creates this really kind of magical experience where what you're trying to do is make sure the content is sort of dynamically recomposing itself every time you advance the story. And so when two panels are on the page, I want to make sure that you're focusing on the next piece of the content. Right? This panel comes up from the bottom because the motion of that panel is sort of bottom to top, and then the next panel comes in right to left. And so every page sort of had a dedicated animation approach to making it work correctly. So this is the scene between Mossadegh and the Shah. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the actual story of Operation Ajax. But this is a sort of a showdown between these two men. But I want you to pay attention to both the sound and the motion as I kind of just sort of gradually tap through this. So it's ever so subtle. Every time you tap, you want to get a little bit of a payoff. Ever so slight. So this is one of the most interesting pages to me in terms of what you can do with a dynamic composition. So you can kind of turn stuff on and off as you proceed through the story. So you get a little bit of an audio cue there, and then it sort of leads you into the next panel. So there's all sorts of different ways to play with language of film, but actually maintaining a reading experience the entire time. Because at any moment when this thing pauses, you're actually just reading basically a dynamically changing comics composition. Also, watch the paper here as I exit the page. I see how they rotate ever so slightly. So this whole world is actually built in 3D, and I'll talk more about that towards the end. But it's Unity driving this entire experience. And so for me, one of the things I got to play with as a creative director is how to create an animation system and an experience that actually honors this the reading of comics. There's another side to this whole thing. It's a historically accurate story. And we wanted to layer in information in a way that made the story come alive and be sort of impactful as an actual historical story. And so occasionally while you're reading, you'll see stars appear that allow you to pull up additional information. And so here you can actually look at this document, and I can actually navigate it on the page. And we didn't want to overload the reader with like stars on every page. There's a real challenge to find a balance. But if you want more information about key moments, you can actually dig down and go deeper. I'm going to fast forward to couple of other pages here just because there's some really cool moments in the story. This is one of my favorite pages in terms of animation. This is Ayatollah Kashani rallying up a crowd of upset Iranian citizens trying to get Mossadegh put back in power. The Royal Guardsmen show up, and this guy is ordered to shoot on them, and he refuses and takes off his uniform and his CO. Shooting. So there's a lot of cinematic impact, right? And I think that was really what I was going for, is trying to reach this, leveraging motion, leveraging sound, and doing it in a way that really, still has you reading, still giving your energy and your attention to this thing, but in a way where you're getting a really big payoff and making it more impactful. I'm going to go to another section now. So one of the challenges we had with this is we had a lot of supplemental content that we didn't know we were going to actually end up being able to use in the final product. We had video footage, we had actual documents, we had photos, and the real challenge for me was like, okay, cool, we're on the iPad now, we can actually embed this stuff. How do we do that? And what I came up with was a sort of like way to integrate the narrator, who's historically fictitious, and use him as a vehicle for delivering the truth of all these other characters. When you're telling something that's historically accurate, there's a lot of sensitivity there. It's one of the reasons why the script took so long to produce. You're finding a balance every day between telling the truth and making it exciting, and it's always a struggle between the two because sometimes the truth can be really boring. And so what we did is we took the historically fictitious narrator and we made him sort of an old man sort of reflecting on his past as one of the young agents in this this operation. And we have him sort of looking through these files at the very beginning of the book. And what I did is I actually made this another part of the app. You can actually go and you can explore these files as a supplemental section. And so this is going to be sideways, so I apologize. I'll just try to work my way through it. But there's these dossiers on each of the characters, right? And so you can actually, as if you were in the first person of the main character looking through them, I'll just do, is that better? There we go. But you could actually, like, explore these, and it's all multi-touch. You can, like, start to play with it. You can also get all OCD and kind of, like, put them away. But, you know, we actually wrote up these dossiers on them. And this is my hope is that, you know, by providing just another drill-down level of information, it'll make people curious, and it'll reinforce the fact that what you're reading is actually a true story. And it'll help delineate between what's historically, you know, hard and fast fact and what's our, you know, slight dramatization to try to make the whole thing flow and work. And I think that's a real challenge when it comes to telling history. It's so sensitive and can be such a divisive thing. The other thing that was really cool about this is we have actual declassified CIA documents. The story of Operation Ajax is pretty well documented. I added the coffee stain because they were very ugly. So, but this is the actual coup plan that was declassified under the Freedom of Information Act. And so now I could integrate that right into the app in a really slick way that allows you to, you know, feel like you're discovering the actual truth. And I think that when it comes to education and really getting people aware of this stuff, it's a really powerful way to sort of build lore in a you know, in very engaging new format. And then the last part that I think is the coolest is we actually have newsreel footage. And these will be sideways too. But actually, I'll just view these in the comic just because it's more interesting instead of playing them sideways. So I'll go to the last chapter and I'll show you one of my one of the sort of darkest but most interesting parts. Oh, I know where I'm gonna go. Yeah, I'm gonna go to chapter. I'll show you Eisenhower getting elected. Oops, if I can figure out which. Not chapter 5. Here we go, chapter 6. So we have this montage on the Red Scare. And the real challenge for me was where to add newsreel footage. Again, you don't want like video footage on every page, and we were sort of at the mercy of what we could find off the internet and license. So it kind of became this like challenge at the end to kind of fit it all together. But this is really cool. This is sort of talking about the backdrop to what was going on in America in the late 40s, early 50s, the rise of the Cold War. And so we used a sort of a montage experience to talk about this, and you can blend, you know, imagery all over the place with lots of cool, you know, effects and noise and stuff. Tyler kind of indulged that one a bit. That was... But it sort of ends with this, but it did have one real effect, right, in terms of what this all meant.
It was election year in America, and Adlai Stevenson, former governor of Illinois, became the standard-bearer of an enthusiastic Democratic Party at its Chicago convention. A short time later, the Republican convention met at San Francisco and made short work of its nomination. Their choice by acclamation was...
Watch Eisenhower's hands at the end of this. It's really cool.
As returns rolled in on election night, the result was never in doubt. It was a landslide for the Eisenhower-Nixon ticket and America's resounding vote of confidence in its leader.
There it is. So now when you go to the next page, right, we have them all kind of... I thought that was really cool. It kind of all blends together. And it's like... Anyway, so you get the idea. So I'm going to go back to the laptop now. So I don't know if I still need sound, but I'll just plug this in anyway. Cool. So I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of other aspects of the app. So I came up with this dynamic composition to arrange the panels in a really cool way. At first, we weren't sure what tool we were going to use for that because we knew that Flash wasn't going to work on iOS devices. And back in 2010, there was like, what tool do we use? I mean, you know, you need a multi-timeline editor to do this kind of stuff. If any of you guys work in motion graphics or in Interactivity in general, which you probably all do, right? You're going to know that that just doesn't work. And so we tried to use Maya at first, thinking that maybe we'll be able to export the data and that's going to work. And it was terrible. Maya Maya doesn't have a multi-timeline editor, and it doesn't do all these other things, you know, in real time very well. Primarily, we need to translate, rotate, scale, alpha, and tint. And so I actually ended up using Flash to mock up the very first chapter because I needed to do a lot of creative exploration. And so I think the lesson from that is that sometimes you just don't have the right tool at the right time, so just go play and figure it out, and you'll be able to catch up later. This is a Photoshop mock-up of what my pre-planning looks like when it comes to planning out some of this animation. And so what I do is I give this to my animators, and they're able to go off of this. This is sort of a beat-by-beat flow through Photoshop of me just taking the print comics and breaking them up into these compositions. And, you know, the most minimal of direction to show how that stuff slides off. And so that page is interesting because it actually has two scenes on it. And I'm like, well, why not just leverage that? We can infinitely lay out the content however we want now because there's no limitations. It's not like we have to print more pages. And so this is what that composition sort of became later in the book after being flowed through Photoshop. A note on sound, right? It's a reading experience first and foremost. And you want just enough sound to fill in the gaps. You know, you don't ever want to go silent unless you want to make a dramatic point. And you want to figure out when to use room tone, when to use music, when to use sound effects. And what I found at the end of the day is that you just need enough audio to make it work. And I think that you know, the guy who was working with us came from a film background. And it's really tempting to want to keep pushing it more and more. But again, it's the art of restraint. It's really about just enough to make it work. And that's actually beneficial because it also makes it less expensive and faster to create. The value of user experience. So we had kind of ignored this for a really long time, and it really hurt first time around. We had spent all of our energy on making the story awesome and making sure the art looked great and making sure the interactivity was really cool, but we didn't really focus on how people were going to access this as a piece of software. And, you know, all you have to do is user test once. I'm sure this is, like, obvious to a lot of people, but when you're making anything interactive, you got to be accounting for the fact that it's going to be on a device that doesn't have buttons. And trying to get people used to turning the page and all this other stuff, I think it's better now, but it really took a while to make that work. When I think about you know, sort of the layers of how people access an experience like this, you know, at the core of it is a story. If you don't have a good story, what's the point of all the other things, right? You need good story, then you need good presentation, so all the art and sound and animation and whatnot. And then on top of that, of course, is the interface. So you're basically creating an awesome UX to provide a great presentation to what ultimately should be a great story. If the story is weak, it's not going to really add any value to what you're doing. Enhanced content, the black hole of the ebook. I think this has been discussed a lot. The question is, how do you add content to a book and enhance it when you can add infinite content? It becomes a really dicey proposition because your temptation is to just dump everything in there, and learning where to draw the line is really hard. You can layer in books within books within books within films within, etc. So, you know, I just showed you guys sort of the technique in the desktop. Really figuring out where to draw the line to make people curious but not give them the whole story is important. And I think the reason that that's important is because at the end of the day, what you want them to do is become curious. You want them to actually go pick up Stephen Kinzer's book or go watch a documentary or go on Wikipedia or find all these other sources that document this stuff. And so basically I call it the power of tangential learning, and to me what that means is it's a tune drill down. It's something that's going to make you, you know, just get curious enough to want to go one level deeper. It kind of looks like this, right? So at the core experience is the comic, which means that if all you're going to do is read the comic, you need to make sure that that's a complete experience, that it gives you all the information you need so that if that's all you do, you're going to know who the people were and what the times and dates were. We had to go back and edit things to make sure that, you know, people were calling each other by names a little more often than not so that you knew who they were and things like that. And then the curiosity takes you one level deeper, and you're going to pull up a document or a reel. And then from that, hopefully you'll want to actually go off and start digging around on your own. It's like drinking from a fire hose. If you just give everybody all the information at once, they're gonna tune out. So I think that's really important for building that stuff in the future. So where do we go from here? Well, you guys may not be able to tell, but Ajax is actually built in Unity. It's actually a game engine under the hood driving the entire experience. It's all real-time 3D. We didn't really get a chance to explore that because we were so busy just trying to get this thing done with basic, you know, flat animation, which I think is still pretty profound. But there's a lot of room for experimentation here, right? What does it mean when a game engine is driving a comic book? Well, there's a lot of opportunity to explore, and I'm looking forward to digging into that soon. But in terms of just the larger idea of what our media is doing, I mean, the app space is now intersecting with your television in your living room, right? And so it makes me wonder, you know, as we transition out of this sort of handheld modality to a space where, you know, you suddenly have big budget console games existing, what's that overlap going to look like? And what does it mean when our experiences can be built in a game engine? You know, basically, we're now seeing AirPlay allow us to connect our mobile devices to our TVs, and the whole living room ecosystem is changing in reaction to this. And I don't know, it's both terrifying and exciting. One of the reasons why I find it personally terrifying is that there's some pretty extreme barriers here, at least for us. As you guys know, the App Store is typically a 99-cent or a freemium experience, and we should really be an EPUB or a book. If this was a printed book, it would be a $20 commodity, right? And there would be a tangible analog thing to compare it to. But EPUB doesn't support crazy technology. It doesn't support game engines and all the bells and whistles. And so we're at a bit of a disconnect in terms of consumer expectation right now, in terms of how people value this stuff. And so all the other people experimenting and pioneering, they're awesome. We're all kind of like taking one for the team, so to speak, because it's going to, I think this stuff is eventually going to be very successful, but we need support from Apple, and we need support from Android, and we need an ability to market our content correctly. The flip side to all of this is that you also have the console era, right? The iPad 3 just got announced. It's got crazy 3D capabilities, and it can probably rival the consoles or start to. And, you know, that ecosystem of games is a $60 experience, and it's siloed, right? Not everybody can publish there. So it makes me wonder what's going to happen when all these things start to converge. You know, as people say, they don't really want in-app purchases in their console games. So anyway, so on to recap, incorporating the lessons of Stradivarius. You know, if we hadn't made a traditional comic book first, we never would have been able to make a successful digital experience, I don't think. And again, the question for all of you guys that I have is how do we maintain the value of these like beautiful traditions, you know, of the past as we go forward and pioneer the future? I just want to add that we're working with BoomGen. I'm really excited about that, to really turn this into a game and an educational resource. And so if anybody has any questions about this stuff, I'd be happy to talk to you after. But if you want to come to the mics, that's basically it. We're 40 minutes, 42, so thanks so much. I think so.
How are you guys handling file size? One of the issues we have going on about series is that we've got to keep file sizes down because we want people buying 10 of them and having 2 gigabytes on their iPad.
It's an interesting point. I mean, Ajax is 407 megs right now. One of the challenges that we faced, not just from a file size download perspective, but also from a it's a game engine, so we had to figure out how to compress our images and stuff, and that was pretty difficult. So I don't really have advice for that. I think that we're going to see the storage space on these things just keep going up. You know, we're at 64 gigs, and I think that, you know, eventually that'll be like the smallest iPad you can buy. And I don't know if our content's going to keep ballooning beyond that. I think the most sensitive issue right now for iOS is the 20 megabyte download limit, because that, I think, is really where you get the most impact. I think that at the end of the day, I mean, it kind of goes back to the bookshelf, right? Apps are temporary. You kind of just delete them when you're done with them, and there's nothing to show for it afterwards. And I'm more concerned about that versus the space thing than I am about, oh, how are we going to fit all this stuff on there? But I think that it's a good point. It depends on what you're trying to create. If you're doing a serialized thing, then that's, you know, obviously you're going to have to contend for that.
My name's Christopher Allen. I have a new app for authors to be able to create infinite canvases, much easier than what you're trying to do, but it doesn't do as much. How big is the team that did this is maybe my first question. The second thing, did you consider any kind of nonlinear narrative?
Okay, two-part question. So first part, how big is the team? Well, the largest part was the artists. We had about 60 people in total work on this, mostly because we kept trying to experiment to find the best way to produce our content. At the end of the day, the team that worked the best for us was an on-site team in San Francisco, headed by Sergio Paez, and they were about 5 guys. So if you were to use that team going forward, you could probably do it with a team of about 10 people, but it was about 60 total that worked on this book. So it was a big experiment, so to speak. And then in terms of branching storyline, I think Choose Your Own Adventure is where I go when I think about that. Everyone usually asks about that. I loved those books when I was a kid. You'd like jam like 6 fingers into the thing so you could go back. I'm going to get it right this time. It's cool. I think you can do it with text really easily, but the moment you start to add illustrations or any sort of like labor-intensive content, there's a big risk. And I know in games the big sort of point that holds us back is that there's a big chance your audience is never going to see that content, right, if you're not going to play through it multiple times and try going in those directions. And so it's sort of hard to justify from a financial perspective. I think with comics, there's maybe less of a concern of that because it's a lot less expensive to support branching narrative with content. It's one of the benefits of comics, actually, is that it's relatively inexpensive to produce, you know, illustrations. Where I think it's the most successful is where you branch right at the end of a chapter or at the end of an episode of a gameplay experience. And from there, you know, you can have a win-lose scenario that sort of changes your outcome for the next thing.
I encourage you to look at not just choose your own adventure, but change your point of view. So follow the detective or follow the murderer.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, Calvin Reed from Publishers Weekly. Love the presentation. It was really great. I'm just curious about the structure. I think you told me about it one time about selling it by chapters, and could you talk about that a little bit? And how much? How much of an audience were you able to get for the?
The first app, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so for those who don't know, we actually did a release of this in December of 2010, and it was totally premature, and we learned a lot of lessons about when you're supposed to come out with something and when you shouldn't. Like, if you only have 2 chapters out of 10 available, don't release your thing. And if you have bad UX, don't release your thing. And if the story's confusing, don't release your thing. So we had a reboot of sorts in November, but the original strategy was to release a chapter for free and then say, okay, cool, here's a chapter for free, now please buy the next one for whatever amount of money. I don't think that fails necessarily, but I think that just the way comics are structured, at least for our book, you need to have episodic content from the get-go. You need to really leave them with a ridiculous cliffhanger and sell the crap out of it in the first chapter, or else it's they're kind of left hanging and they might not go for it, right? And I don't know, there's a flip mentality to that. The more money I put into this, the more invested I get, right? It's kind of the Mafia Wars, craziness. You know, it must be worth money because I spent money on it, so here's more of my money. And then it's just kind of, you know. But I don't really think that graphic novels work that way. I think it's kind of if someone slaps down their $8 or whatever, they're in it for the ride. They're like, well, they might get a little rough in patches, but God damn it, I committed my $8, so now I want to see that, you know, financial commitment through. I think that there's different ways to balance it. I think we're all experimenting right now. I mean, maybe you give away half the book for free and then you charge for the second half, or maybe you give away all of it except for the last chapter and really maybe piss people off. I don't know. But there's no right or wrong way to do it. And we're going to do a light version next and a phone version next, which is really cool. So if you guys have iPhones, it miniaturizes amazingly well. And I think that what's cool about that is you can actually give someone a single chapter that's really powerful and has a really strong call to action and actually leverages all the benefits of mobile. But we didn't really pay attention to the mobile sort of mentality at first, and that was a huge downside for us at the beginning.
Hey. I was wondering what's your opinion, now that you've completed this big project with a large team, where do you think this is going to go in the future for maybe smaller scale projects, like a webcomic, considering launching itself as an app instead of as a webcomic from an independent producer? Do you think it will scale well enough to the small scale for one person or even a small team of 2 or 3 people to develop?
No, yeah. I mean, it depends on the scale and scope of what you want to do. I mean, Ajax was the I call it the Tijuana Supremo package to rip off Aqua Teen Hunger Force. It's just we overindulge the animation so much, and it's beautiful and it's awesome, but I think that there's definitely a line of impact. I mean, I'm an artist, so I tend to value things based on their aesthetics and based on their artisanal qualities, and especially in the mobile space, the bar is not actually that high in a lot of places, so you can find a balance, and I think that if you're coming at it from the comics creator's perspective, it's really more about story and some great illustrations and something that's really fun to read, and less about all this, you know, bang whiz, flash, cool, look at me stuff. There's levels you can do it with. I think that as the tools evolve, yes, you can. But I don't know. I don't think it's impossible. I think it's hard now, but it's going to get easier.
Height difficulties. I have 2 questions. One, the first one is, I know that you were trying to maintain the authenticity of the comic, but I kind of have to wonder, considering that the format is completely different, you don't need to obey page. Why did you choose to obey page and while keeping the panel format and basically a continuous scroll versus pages?
Well, we actually had a technical limitation. It's a game engine at its core, so we're under real-time limitations. And so it was actually really convenient that the page gave us this break, because what that does is it allows the iPad to dump all the content out of memory and actually load in the next set of texture maps and geometry. So that's not to say that you couldn't improve that in the future. If you guys ever, a lot of people here probably play video games, I imagine. Remember when Tony Hawk went to like open world and you could like skate forever, and it was like, you know, maybe you'd skate through a tunnel, but it was like continuous versus like loading the next thing. And you can, there's different approaches, and I'm sure that you can pick an aesthetic that matches. I actually liked aesthetically the page break. I think it was kind of a cool change of scene. But if you're not changing a scene and you're just continuing a scene across multiple pages, I think that then that's when you would continue to roll the panels up or down or left to right.
Okay, and then my second question was, you hear a lot of talk about, I'm a digital marketer by trade, not an artist, so I hear a lot of talk about people who want to plug in advertising or link to the web or tons of other stuff into written works. And I was wondering, as a creator, what your thought would be if somebody said, well, you can get sponsored by Coca-Cola if that Coke machine is actually enables you to buy a Coke.
Well, yes, you can do all of that stuff. I mean, I'm not going to call like right or wrong on that. I think it just depends on what you want to create, right? I think that you're looking at comics as a tool for storytelling for whatever that story is. I think brands, I was just having this conversation last night over drinks with this guy who's like, would you do commercial work? Wink, wink. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess. You know, I'm not like, oh boy, I'm going to tell the story of Coke. But I think that there's all sorts of opportunities there to really, you know, to make things more engaging in general. Like, I actually have a deep appreciation for a good advertisement. Like, if you can make me laugh or make me profoundly think about something in like 15 to 30 seconds, that's amazing. And that's like, you know, that's the film version of that. But why not have an interactive experience that does that as well, or a comics-based one? I think that there's all these tools coming together, and as our attention gets further divided up and we're constantly pushing things out of the way to like just focus on our, you know, whatever it is we're doing, our Twitter or whatever, right? If you can actually like make something worth my time and engage me and impact me, then I'll respect you as a brand more, perhaps. And I think that there's value in looking at that. And I'm actually really excited to push the gaming and the interactive technology, because that's my background. And so it's like, now I feel like I have a good enough wrangle on comics. I know that it's really hard. But, you know, I really like pushing the 3D camera and being able to, like, look at how you can actually take that format and make it go further.
So when we walked in, I heard Pink Floyd playing, and when I was younger, I bought an album, I would listen to it, you know, on vinyl. A lot of people don't even know what albums are these days, but, you know, I'd listen to it, and it was a concept, and it was put together much like what I'm seeing here, and now everything, I have a 15-year-old, and everything is so snackable, and it's so short, and the attention span is so short, and he wants quick things all the time. Can you give us a little bit of insight on what the demographics are for something like this, and what's more important, the format, the length, the content? Are you trying to reach a younger audience? Is that going to become a problem with a graphic novel that's this size?
That's a good question. Well, originally I wanted to try to bring Stephen Kinzer's story to like 17-year-olds. Because, I mean, let's face it, if everyone read more books, just generally speaking, I think we'd all be in a better place. But, you know, it turns out that I think that young people, when they see it, are interested in this. But, you know, one of the reactions is like, well, that's not Harry Potter. And I'm like, you know, like, or like, wow, the story's really boring. And I'm like, I know, there's history at the beginning. I'm sorry. Like, you know, let's just please. So it's a challenge. And I think that you're going to constantly have to adjust for multiple, you know, targets, right? Like, if someone's young, yeah, there's just certain topics that are going to be harder to engage them on. But the format itself, I think, is super legit. I think that people, when they read it for the first time, get really sucked in and think it's really cool. So, I mean, you could tell any story this way. You know, you could tell, take any major IP and you could, like, you know, skin it and do stuff with it. And I think that there's all sorts of new ways to make that engaging. So I think as long as people find the story interesting, or find what they're doing with it interesting, and they're not constantly being bombarded by, like, you know, all the other things that compete in our electronic, you know, digital consciousness, I think it would be fine for both young and old people, and even the people in between. No more questions, really? No one's going to come up and, like... Yeah.
So, when I was a kid, one of the main things that sort of made me not like reading comics was not the stories or how beautiful it was drawn. It was, there's just too much information on the page, and I always felt like there was something out of the corner of my eye that was distracting. And so I feel like this really, in a lot of ways, solves that problem. So I was wondering if that was intentional or if it was just happy accident.
I'll tell you the story. So it was Watchmen Motion Comics, and as much as I knock them, it still gave me an idea. And this, I guess, it came out of Kirby Ferguson's like remix everything thing the other day. right? Like good artists steal. I effing stole from like the Watch and Motion. Like I still don't, you know, I still think what we did is better. I mean, I do. But what it was is I read the Watchmen graphic novel and I consumed it so fast. I'm like, oh boy, a book, you know, and just like constantly, you don't even stop to take in the illustrations. And I'm like, that was okay. It was kind of old, you know, like it was made in the 80s. And then I watched the movie and I'm like, that was okay. It was kind of like a recreation of the book and it was really long and it still kind of felt like it was made in the 80s. And then I like went on iTunes and I like pulled up the Motion comic because I was curious. And, you know, the guy's voice was hilarious. That's kind of why he's like doing like, oh, I'm a woman. Oh, I'm a guy, you know, and they're like talking. And then, but what was so amazing to me is that it made me slow down and totally see one panel at a time. It's a video experience. You can't like speed through it. And I got the syncing up of, you know, Alan Moore's writing with the illustrations, Dave Gibbons' illustrations. And it was so profound. I didn't actually get how good it was because I was like not paying attention. I wasn't honoring the experience. And what I thought was like, wow, that really made me like stop and appreciate the pairing of those two things. And how cool would it be if I could create something that had all the benefits of like, you know, reading a book, you know, and incorporated motion and video. So that, it was intentional. I wanted to slow you down and really make you see. And once I had you starting and stopping along the way, I'm like, ha, are you curious about this guy? Because there's a thing you can click right there. And you can't really do that in film, right? Like, you're kind of like, if you watch a documentary, you're like, oh, I'm so engaged, and boy, I just want to, like, tear away to, like, look up a thing. And then maybe it ends, you're like, well, now I'm depressed, and I need to go, like, out to dinner with my boyfriend, and I won't actually go back and do that now. You know, there's different opportunities in a reading experience versus a film one. So, yes, I think this is the short answer to that question.
Well done.
Works as a follow-up to that, actually, because I was curious. I know you were saying that it was very important to you all to respect the art of a comic as a reading experience, but then you also had some of those inserts that were like the newsreels. Mm-hmm. And do you think that there might come an opportunity, or did you all stop yourselves from like putting a cinematic sequence like the way it is in like a video game? Because like you can still, I mean, like you could do it Zelda style and like nobody has to talk and you could still respect the fact that nobody, there's no dialogue.
8-bit Mosaic? Yeah, maybe. No, it's true. Well, I think that the moment, you know, the newsreels are very obviously not the comic, right? It's a departure. And I feel like my expectations change when that comes up. And because it's a video, I'm like, oh, well, I can just skip this, boop. But I'm not going to skip any part of the comic, right?
Right.
So I think it's, as long as you make it intentional, like, if the aesthetics had matched, like, for example, actually the very first time we did the book, another problem with the first time we released the book, it was really inconsistent when you would tap forward. You'd, like, tap, and sometimes it would, like, play through and then pause awkwardly and then keep going, and you'd be like, wait, am I... Now I'm just confused. Why am I, okay, this is too hard. And you just, you know. So that actually broke the experience. What actually worked from a user testing perspective, user testing, very, very important. Tap once and always have the same amount of time go by. And I get into a rhythm and there's expectation there. And that's how you go buttonless, right? That's how you know when to go and when to stop. So yes, you can do it. The risk there is that you can potentially break the user's expectations and break the user experience. So that's why we chose not to.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you. It was really an amazing panel, and I'm privileged to come up here and ask you a question. My name is John.
I have flyers and I have cards, so you guys can...
So I come from a background in 3D animation. I worked at a company here on a game freelancer and then another one that got canceled. I'm self-producing a short web series with 3D animation and kind of cell animation. It's called Space Adventure, and I'm doing this kind of show to bring back space and all this stuff and make it entertaining for kids. So I'm a one-person studio, and I've done all the work, and I'm wanting to parlay what I'm doing into an iPad application and kind of make it edutainment. And so what you've done is you've taken an entertaining, you've taken a historical story, and you've made it entertaining in a graphic novel format. So in doing so, what were the challenges in making it engage and compelling story, and then keeping it authentic to the history? And then the second question is, how are you going to incorporate 3D application into the next version of that?
Ah, well, TBD on the 3D application.
Okay.
We're actually not going to do a historical story to do that because I just want to go after the tech now. And actually, it's because of the challenge of writing a fun, engaging, historically accurate story that I'm not doing that, because that is what used up all of our time. We were constantly like misspelling people's names, and the Farsi was backwards, and like all these things where I'm like, I can't actually do that. I don't know what I'm, you know, I can make it look pretty, but can I actually make it accurate? It was like I had to take on all these different roles, and it was exhausting. It was just so much work. So I think, you know, we're constantly like, I wouldn't say arguing with Stephen Kinzer, but we'd be like, it's like this. And he's like, well, it was a telegram, not a phone call. And we're like, who cares? Like, that's not an important part of the plot. Like, you know, it's, there's like bigger problems to be solving than like whether the guy called him or sent him a telegram. And so every plot point of the story required like that, like back and forth with Stephen. And I mean, we conceded on a lot of stuff. That's why we have all this history at the beginning. But, you know, so it's this constant wrestling match between like make it interesting and make it fun. And I, no matter what the format is, whether it's a movie or what, you know, or a video game you know, plot or whatever it is, you're always going to have that challenge. And I guess my hope is that the more tools you have to convey, the easier you can make it flow and be fun and engaging, right? Like, we had to create a narrator. I knew that right at the very beginning. And then by making him historically fictitious, we can, like, put him all these places that, like, a real person might not actually be. And by me keeping him nameless, his name was supposed to be redacted from one of the documents. It turns out all the names that were redacted were actually Iranians, but, yeah. And anyway, there's different vehicles for not only just in narrative-based, visual storytelling, but also in adding, you know, documents, interactivity, and things like that allow you to supplementally add in information so that you can get the full ramp, right? Which is why I said the core comic story has to satisfy, but then, like, for the Snickers bite or whatever, going deep down in the layers, like the peanuts or whatever, or the, I don't know, the caramels below. It's a thing. Anyway.
Thank you, and one last comment is I'd love to see a documentary about what you guys did, because it took you over 3 years, right, to make this?
Yeah, this is actually the beginning of year 5.
Wow, year 5? Well, anyway, congratulations and keep it going. I'm very inspired.
Thank you. I'd like to think that I'm that interesting that we would make a documentary.
Hey, Daniel, hey, thanks. Great stuff. Love your process. Like to see the exhibition. I'm a documentary filmmaker who's also working on for 2 years a doc, 4 years, and also an ebook. So what tip would you give to documentary makers who want to bring animation in to the ebook format to tell their story based on what you know about animation?
The tune drill down. Don't overwhelm people with information. Make them get curious and then give them a piece that kind of like, it's like a leaving a trail of M&Ms to, you know, Gargamel's house or whatever, like with Gargamel's house being a place of knowledge and goodness. But the idea that you should tweet that one, that'll get retweeted like now. Anyway, but that's the idea. It's like you're leaving them clues and crumbs. And so at the core of it, I'm entertained and I'm enjoying myself. And then, you know, it's not that curiosity is a bad thing or not fun, but you want to give people an opportunity to, like, now that they're not worried about being entertained, they're worried about learning something. And that's a huge disconnect, yeah. Especially in the mobile space, where it's like, this isn't Angry Birds. What is this? Oh, it's about Iran. I'm not sure if I like this, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what we're up against. Right. But I think that, you know, once you can be like, haha, I've got your attention. Now you're going to follow me over here. And then, you know, at the end of it, you're like, that was really amazing. And now I'm really sad. And now I want to know how I potentially can, like, learn more about, you know, say, this particular topic or whatever it is you're trying to tell a story about. We're over by a minute and 11 seconds. I'd love to keep talking to you guys. So I guess, what are we allowed to do? Am I allowed to obviously not stand up here and be mic'd? Nothing? Outside? Okay, I guess I'll be over there. Thanks for coming. Sure.